a doctor in the house.
Doctor, doctor, give me the news. I got a bad case of loving you.
Doctor.
It's time for Advanced Medicine Monday with Dr. Rashid Batar.
I'm a doctor, not a bricklayer.
I'm a doctor, not a mechanic.
I'm a doctor, not a coal miner.
The doctor is in.
Taking on bureaucrats and corporations that would stand in the way of health freedom and making sense out of medical propaganda. The voice of health, freedom, and liberty, Robert Scott Bell.
Cranking it up again with Dr. Rashid Batar here. Advanced Medicine Monday continues. And boy, oh boy, do we have a story we got to dive headlong into. We talk about atrocities of modern medicine, talk about atrocities of modern medicine bound into government and the heavy hand of government trying to force another child against the will of the child and the parents to take chemotoxic cancer medicine. This is an outrage. Natural News is found at Mike Adams' outrage. And, of course, Dr. Rashid Batar outraged as well. Dr. Batar, welcome back.
Hey, Robert. How are you?
Doing well. But, boy, this story has got me just... And another one of these outrages that you just got. When will they give up on this idea of ownership of these children?
Well, you know, the interesting thing about this story for me was that the parents, and I guess maybe we need to summarize what the story was, but what's interesting about this particular story is that this cancer, Ewing sarcoma, which is an aggressive form of cancer, in this particular child, three PET scans over the last year have shown no trace of any type of cancer. And the oncologist, a female doctor, is the one who basically complained to the Michigan Human Health Services or Child Protection Services.
Yeah, up there in Michigan.
Right, exactly. And, you know, what's really intriguing about this is that she took it upon herself to notify this Children's Protection Agency and then went to court, and the court ruled in favor of the parents. And she, I don't know whether she compelled or they went twice, and two times the judges apparently have dismissed this, and now they've appealed it. The medical profession, the doctor, has been the cause of this entire, you know, strange, I don't even know what the hell to call it. It's an atrocity.
They said,
I mean, this
guy, Michael P. Ferris with the HSLDA, confirmed that the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services has filed suit to force the parents to administer the chemicals to their son, even though he's been clean of cancer on scans over the past year, and even though lower courts, as you said, have ruled against the demands of the state. So they appealed it. The state agency filed an appeal with the Michigan Court of Appeals demanding that this little 9-year-old Jacob, and, you know, we both have young sons. Can you imagine the state trying to force our sons to get this? I mean, you're talking about an act of war against a child and against the family.
And this woman has been the impetus behind this oncologist. And it's interesting that Michael Ferris, who I've already sent an email to, actually, since you sent me this story, I've already sent an email to them regarding offering my services to help them in any which way they want. But I told them in the email that, as far as I'm concerned, the problem here is that doctor. And she should be brought up on charges of malpractice because the drugs that she's trying to get this child to take are not even approved by the FDA for children. In fact, it clearly states on the drug inserts that they want the child to be on, that it's not approved for use in children. So this oncologist is insisting that the family put her child on three different drugs that aren't even approved by the FDA for the child, for a child. And on top of that, it's not even indicated because the child is not showing any evidence of any kind of cancer. So this woman should be brought up on charges. I think she should be sued for malpractice and for child endangerment herself.
Yeah,
in fact, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I sent this in the email. I said that she should be brought up on attempted murder charges because to give a drug like that to a child is nothing short of putting them at grave and dire risk.
Yeah, it's horrific. I mean, when you read the effects and the known effects of this medicine on children, I mean, they say not only is it not the safety and effectiveness in pediatric patients not been established, but they also say that the pediatric patients are at an increased risk for developing delayed cardiotoxicity. I mean, I imagine this could induce cardiac failure in a child, even if they quote unquote survive the initial treatment.
Absolutely, without a doubt. And Robert, it even says in this article, and it references this particular combination of chemotherapeutic agents has been shown to actually cause secondary cancers.
Wow. So even causes cancer. It even causes, I mean, here, this kid has showing no signs of cancer. They want to give this woman doctor, wants to give the chemo agent to the, and it can cause more cancer.
Here's what the author of the article says. Have all these drugs been approved by the FDA as safe and effective for children? I asked Jacob's treating oncologist. Yes, she replied. They have been FDA approved for children. However, according to the official package inserts mandated by the government to describe the drugs contained and their complications, she was flat wrong, Ferris said.
She flat out lied, I'd say. I mean,
absolutely. That's one reason I think she should be brought up in charges of child endangerment herself. And actually, as far as I'm concerned, attempted murder, because she's trying to kill this kid. That's exactly what would happen to this kid if the parents didn't stand up and blindly follow what this idiot doctor's saying.
Wow. I mean, this is stunning, stunning, stunning. And you and I were talking about this off the air, and I've often said that the allopathic medicine, as it's largely practiced in the Western world, is a very male-dominated profession. It's very masculine. So, you know, it's very aggressive if we say that. And I'm thinking the women that go into this, and I get in trouble for saying this, but I'm, you know, hey, it's the nature of talk radio. It's controversial. Have to almost give up some level of their femininity to do this. And I know I'm going to get slapped around for this, but I'm saying for a woman of all things, and I'm not excusing the men that would do the same thing here, but I'm just saying for a woman should have a maternal instinct to protect the child here, demanding that the child be poisoned even after lower courts said this is not right. It's infuriating to me.
Well, I'll share the slaps that you're going to get, because here's what my observation has been. And you're absolutely right. It's not an excuse for any men, but you would think that a woman is going to be more, as you said, maternal, more naturally holistic, if you will, not as aggressive. But, you know, when you look at the profession of medicine, women have had such a difficult time breaking through, and they've always been characterized by the males in the profession as almost like the token doctor, you know, the token female doctor. And this was more probably 15, 20 years ago. But in the field of general surgery, which is what I trained in, it was amazing that the women surgeon residents were the worst people to work with. We actually referred to the female chief residents as malignant. This is all the nursing staff, male or women, it didn't matter. The hospital administrative staff, the other residents, the other specialties, everybody referred to their chief residents that were females. We had three teams at Brook Army Medical Center, Fort Sam, when I was doing surgery residency there. And then also, you know, every team that had a woman surgeon on it was referred to chief resident was a woman, was referred to as malignant. Now, I'll tell you, there were a couple of really, really cool women, yeah, too, that were chief residents, but they always went into either urological surgery or they went into something else. They weren't the general surgeons. The general surgery, we do eat our own. I mean, that's just a known thing.
Yeah, it's
but
brutal.
Women, the women were just absolutely, they were the worst human beings
but
to deal with.
Listen, I know we're getting into trouble here, and that's just the nature of what we do, and we'll
but
take
think,
our
I think
bark.
Part of that is probably because they had a chip on their shoulder, and they yeah. felt like that they had to prove
they
themselves
to,
in a man's world.
Yeah.
And so they overcompensate.
Yeah. And that, like I said, that bugs me, because I think to bring the feminine side, because we all acknowledge at least we do here, that we all have a masculine feminine traits. I mean, it doesn't mean this is not about being gay or straight. That's not what we're talking about here. Just energies, if you will. And
I've been told, Robert, that I am more in tune with my feminine side than most male, and I've taken that as a compliment.
Yeah, well, that's what I want people to understand. That's what we're talking about here. But if you talk about a woman going into that profession thinking that she has to basically abandon that side of her, and it's very intuitive and it's very healing and nourishing, that's where it bugged me in my interaction with the docs that said they had to compensate more just to make it in the so-called male-dominated culture. But I was saying, if you're going into this for the right reasons, you do not give up who you are, because who you are is the healer. Right? It's not trying to fit in. It's like, this is your gift. Let it flow. And this woman, the gift, unfortunately, seems to be attacking and denigrating and abusing children in this way. That's what's so disheartening about this story.
She's trying to further her own agenda, or perhaps her own name, by trying to do something. She's creating the wrong light for herself. The difference for me here is if this was a guy versus a girl, if it was a male doctor, I would have already threatened him and taken him out in the back and taught him a lesson physically. And a woman, I would have just expected more.
Yeah. Well, I don't see her name listed anywhere in the story. Do you? I haven't found it. So she's so far going unnamed unless you've seen it there. But I tell you
what. I did not see it, but, you know, pretty much any doctor, I think when it gets to this level, I think that for her own protection, they probably didn't put her name in there because I'm sure there's more than one person that would want to.
Yeah, have some words with her. Let's just say that. So we have a situation here that not only, okay, we may have a rogue doctor. In this case, the lower courts have actually ruled correctly, in our opinion, in the appeals court now. I don't know what's going to happen here. But this idea of the sanctity of the family is another issue that I want to talk to you about, Dr. Bitard, because it's one thing when a family, let's say, interacts with the medical community and then they interact with other people and they make an informed decision. But it's another when the government comes in and says, no, we don't like your informed decision because it's not sanctioned by us. And that's, we come back to the medical monopoly and the danger of that, not only for the family, but also for the doctors, just as yourself, because you've been victimized by this medical monopoly for being a renegade, for actually doing something that works rather than the ill-defined, undefinable standard of care that doesn't.
Well, you know, it's interesting you bring that up because the complaints, those four complaints against me, all four of them who were not patients, who were, you know, you've heard me say that they weren't patients. I've never talked to them. I've never emailed them. There's been no communication. But one of those four was a doctor who didn't know anything about what we did. But the patient had gone to the doctor. The doctor wanted to do certain things. The patient refused and then came to me. And that's when the doctor complained to the medical board.
Hmm.
Because the patient refused to do what she wanted to do and instead came to me.
Yeah, so it was sort of out of spite or anger or who knows, any number of things that they would utilize their own monopoly status to use the medical boards, licensing boards. Listen, I think, you know, if you have some form of a certification, private certification, and you've been through medical school, you've got your degree, good Lord, why do you need to be licensed by a bunch of yahoos that can't do what, you know, could and should be done if you really use the intelligence and the training that you were given?
Well, it's one of the things that the Supreme Court has already ruled on with the case of EDTA back in the 1980s. I believe it was in the 1980s or maybe it was in the 1970s when the medical board, a medical board, I don't remember exactly which state it was, but a medical board tried to make the case where EDTA was being used off-label for heart disease in the process of chelation.
Right.
And the physician's desk reference in the 1950s actually had EDTA listed as indicated for heart disease. But upon the advent of cardiovascular bypass surgery, or what we call CABG, coronary artery bypass grafts, they took the EDTA listing out of the physician's desk reference, and it no longer was indicated for heart disease. But it was originally. And what was interesting is when the medical board, whichever this medical board was, I have a feeling it was Georgia, but I can't remember, tried to take a doctor's license for the use of EDTA, and it was appealed all the way up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court ruled that the medical board does not have a license to practice medicine.
Hmm.
Only the doctors that practice medicine and have a license to practice medicine can make that decision. And the medical board's job is to license doctors, but the medical board itself does not have a license to practice medicine and therefore cannot make that type of a conclusion. So what you just said about these yahoos licensing you,
yes,
you know, it's exactly what even the highest court in the land has already said, that these yahoos as a group, the medical board as a group, they don't have a license.
Yeah.
So how can they make these kind of calls?
Well, exactly. That's what I'm wondering. And yet they're still operating with a lot of impunity around the states, attacking good doctors, including what you've been through, simply for succeeding where they're failing or where these other doctors are not doing well and they get jealous or who knows what it is. And then they use these boards that are deigned to protect the public. We know that that is not the case in reality. It's just like they like to believe it. We're going to keep the bad doctors away. Yet they tend to attack the good doctors, and some of the worst doctors and even molesting doctors are protected by these things.
Oh, yeah. Doctors have had patients die in their own in-office operating suites. Doctors have cut off the wrong extremity. They've you know, had just very negligent acts that have led to people's deaths inadvertently, and there's been absolutely no disciplinary action, not even a reprimand to these doctors for anything. And it's because they're part of the good old boy network. But as soon as you step outside that good old boy network and you're doing something, especially when it's outside of the box and it's getting results, and it's done in a way that is open and unashamed and done in the light of day and not behind, you know, a curtain or done quietly. And then it attracts more and more patients. And in other words, the more success that you have outside of the box, the more threat it is to the system and the more embarrassing it is to the system, because each success with the non-conventional method is a slap in the way for the conventional method, because it proves that they're obsolete and they're behind the times and they're outdated and they don't know what they're doing.
Well, exactly, exactly. Well, listen, this is what advanced medicine is all about. That's why we do this every week. We love doing it. Of course, the book, 9 Steps to Keep the Doctor Away, everybody pick it up if you haven't already. We've got the links up at robertscottbell.com. We've got a lot more advanced medicine to go today on the show, so don't go anywhere. Say thanks to our sponsors. We'll be right back.
If you're looking for FDA-approved radio, you're listening to the wrong show. This is the Robert Scott Bell Show. Making sense out of medical propaganda. Here's Robert.
You know, last hour we had Dr. Nick Gonzalez back. He was talking about the whole corruption of the NCI, the NIH, and all of these things that were once considered almost sacrosanct. I mean, if the study got published and it was NIH, it's like, oh my gosh, it's legit. And so much information, Dr. Batar, is coming out, so even since you've written your book, about the lack of, let's say, not only validity, but integrity within the scientific conducted test. And you've talked very extensively on these issues of the so-called gold standard in these trials, that even when they're gold standard, may not indeed do what they claim to do. But, oh my gosh, the science is just crumbling right now on so many levels and so many fronts. And people are looking, where do I turn for information? And then you see a crazy doctor like we just talked about trying to attack a child. I think this is all going to backfire on them.
Well, I think that it already has been backfiring. You remember the anesthesiologist that had been publishing papers and had received numerous amounts of remunerations or different sets of remunerations for different studies that he had contributed to or helped to do the research. And I think it was like 16 different studies.
And yeah,
they found
it was
that
huge.
All the data.
Yeah,
that had
it was like was the whole basis for this whole kind of treatment was just, it had no basis.
Exactly. It was all data that had been just conjured up out of nowhere. There was no validity to it whatsoever. It was just all made up. These numbers were randomly put in there, and well, not randomly, they were put in there to make the study show whatever results they wanted the study to show. But they found that it was completely devoid of any science whatsoever. In fact, every component on that study was made up. Mm-hmm. The patients were made up, the numbers were made up, the data, everything was made up. That's no difference from you and I just sitting on the computer and just coming up with something and calling it a study and getting it published.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing. It's that bad. And more evidence coming out that the studies that are considered legitimate are anything but. And yet, this is another aspect of the psychology of what I'm seeing here. It's like you project onto people that which you don't want to see in yourself. And I mean that in terms of
that's something you see a lot of in divorce. A person will project their own inadequacy onto the other counterpart. And yes, you're absolutely right. Projection is the absolute right word here.
Yeah. And so we're seeing that, like, the worst offenders in medicine are accusing all of the natural type docs, alternative or regular docs, of doing the horrific things that they're in fact doing. And it's the holistic. Go ahead.
That they're doing themselves.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's incredible. Really incredible. But, you know, we talked about this as we started this new year, that this was kind of a pivotal year. You're pivoting transition consciousness and stuff. And I see the acceleration of the awareness coming out. All of these faulty studies are now coming to light. And with each one and each time they try to fight it, more people are awakened to see how dangerous that profession is that has lost its way.
That's one reason I personally believe that the high status that was enjoyed by physicians 20 years ago, the pedestal that they were put on before, is now something that most of the public, most of the lay population will just laugh at because they just simply don't trust their doctors.
Yeah. Yeah, I often find it funny when people talk about doctors as if they possess them. Do you ever get annoyed by that, or do you take pride in it? It's hard to say. It's like, I'll talk to somebody. I was talking to a guy, you know, he's like, well, my doctor is different. It's like, your doctor is giving you a statin drug. How is that different? You know, but he's my doctor. I was like, why do you want to possess that? I don't get that.
Well, I mean, I think that it's good that if a person does feel like that they can possess their, you know, that they possess their doctor, because it shows a loyalty, but that's the blind loyalty. And I challenge people all the time, especially my own patients, that, you know, for them to start thinking about things and challenge everything that they hear from not only just the medical profession, but from all sources, you know, whether it's be the internet, whether it be me, it doesn't matter. Challenge it. I kind of like that there are some people that still take possession over their doctors, but most people, I believe, today complain about their doctors or don't trust their doctors. I mean, they're simple. I mean, how many people do you know, Robert, now, just in your own personal life, outside of your close interpersonal relationships, just people that you come across that you meet in everyday life that simply don't trust their doctor or don't trust a doctor?
Yeah, it's true. It is growing. That number is growing. So I guess it's more unusual when I do find somebody that's still in that possessive state, and it is more like a demonic possession when they're giving you statin drugs versus an endearing type of possession.
Exactly. And I think that 20 years ago, you never heard anybody say things like, well, I don't trust my doctor. I mean, they were being sarcastic about the medical profession. You just wouldn't hear it. It would be the same type of sacrilege if you heard somebody say something negative about the government. 20 years ago, people didn't talk negatively about the government. They didn't talk negatively about their doctors. Now, pretty much if you say the government, you know, you need to trust the government's doing the best for you, people would laugh. And the same thing would happen if you said that doctors are looking out for the best for your interest. People would pretty much laugh at that. And the general majority of people that I know, and maybe I'm biased because I have more of the patients that are coming to me that are already cynical about doctors.
Right. Well, the lay persons that are non-doctors have taken a lot of abuse, and they've kept going back for more. I mean, year after year, we're talking decades, because we can cite studies that showed how wrong a lot of the conventional, let's say, standard of care medicine has been for a long time, like hormone replacement therapy. Here we have another publication, Journal of the National Cancer Institute, of all things, showing how HRT with estrogen added raises breast cancer risk. It's not like it's new to us, but how many times do they have to do this before women go, okay, enough already, enough, I'll stop?
No, I know. It's one of the crazy things. In fact, my mom, she ended up getting breast cancer, and I had told her for 8 years. Now, this was, you know, thank God this happened 5 years ago now, and she's, you know, got a clean bill of health. But for 8 years, she was on hormone replacement therapy, and I kept telling her to get off of it. And her answer was, well, if it was dangerous, my doctor would have gotten me off of it. And I kept telling her, you got to stop doing this because it's, you know, it's got estrogen. In fact, she used to call me to try to get me to refill her prescriptions because she hadn't been able to go and follow up with the doctor, and I refused to do it. And, you know, finally my dad put his foot down and said that, I remember there was an argument that my mom and dad got into, and I was telling my mom again, I said, why do you call me to ask me to do this? You know I'm not going to do it, and it's bad for you. You should stop. And I heard her, you know, talking to my dad, and my dad said, fine, we're not going to fill this medication. That's it. We're done. And my mom gave him the same spiel. Well, if it was dangerous, then my doctor wouldn't have prescribed it. And my father said, well, your doctor is not one of the top 50 doctors in the world, like in the United States, like your son is. And so we're going to listen to your son, and we're not going to do it. And that was it. They, you know, my dad refused to let my mom get the prescription. And I think it was like 5 months later, 4 months later, she was diagnosed with breast cancer. And it's the estrogen in there. That's the issue. The estrogen, we're in a very significantly increased estrogen dominant type society now. There's more estrogen that people are exposed to today, something like, I don't remember whether it's 3,000% more than it was 10 years ago, something crazy. I saw this in a study, I think it was from the Environmental Working Group that released that information. But if you look at all the different wild species of animals out there, if you look at the human species or even domesticated animals, you see the penis size of the male of whatever species smaller than when measured historically over the last, you know, so many decades, whenever they've been measuring that.
Yes.
How would that be for a job? You got to go around measuring the penis size of different species. But anyway.
What a job. Yes, what a job. Now, if you talk about that, that's the one thing that will motivate a man to change his diet. If you say, your little guy will get littler, unless you do this, yeah. He'll go, okay, what do I got to do? But,
you know, this is the reason, estrogen dominance, you know, that's one reason I say men should never eat anything from soy, or just, you know, I don't eat anything, and I tell my patients they shouldn't eat anything that's from soy if you're male, especially because of the estrogenic compound components. But then you start looking at things like plastic bottles that we drink our water from, or that we hold the juices that we drink. They're all xenoestrogenic substances that are being leaching in. These chemicals have the xenoestrogenic component. You've got the phytoestrogens in the fruits and vegetables, and then you've got the synthetic estrogens that are in various types of chemicals that we're exposed to, that are in actually the drugs that we're taking. So you've got a combination of these phytoestrogens, xenoestrogens, synthetic estrogens, and then, of course, on top of that, they're trying to put natural bioidentical estrogen into women's hormones. I mean, it's just estrogen, estrogen, estrogen. And people don't seem to understand that the precursor of all the hormones is cholesterol. And then if you want to come down the cascade, progesterone is a precursor for testosterone and for estrogen. So if you, somebody really needs some precursor, then fine, give them progesterone and let the body convert it. But to give the end hormone estrogen, and I know the real supposed experts in bioidentical hormones will say, well, not all, it's not, there's three different types of estrogens and it all depends which one you give them. That's all ludicrous. It's all hogwash. It's all hocus pocus baloney. The precursor is progesterone, and if you give the body what it needs and you give the body the right mineral complex and you detoxify the system, guess what? Progesterone will convert into whatever the body needs, and you don't need to give anybody any other hormones.
Well, and as you said, even the precursor to that is the cholesterol that everybody's still freaking out about. Like I said, a guy, really intelligent guy, I'll say that. He's open to a lot of things, and I literally laid it out for him. He says, you know, you've just basically, everything you said is 100% in opposition to what my doctor is telling me. I said, yes, it's about time you learned it. And in this study, there was actually a quote here that they're trying to put it off on. Maybe it's not that it's the estrogen and HRT, but it could be that we're using too much mammography in screening these hormone users. So they're admitting their detection technology could be contributing to the cancer, and they're thinking that's a good thing, so you'll stay on your HRT because it could just be the mammograms that we still want to give you.
Yeah, it's absurd. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. But, you know, how about stopping the mammograms and stopping the hormonal replacement therapy?
Hello? Yeah. I mean, is anybody home there? It's amazing that they'll use, well, the fact that we acknowledge it, but otherwise they're going to say, no, you must keep doing your mammograms. No, we cannot acknowledge thermography. You know, on and on it goes. And yet, as I said, there are still women out there gullible, and men too. But yes, the estrogen dominance being a significant factor in so many cancers and other disruptive type imbalances that we've got a long way to go clean up. Again, that's why in the 9 steps to keep the doctor away, you talk about the endocrine, you know, rebalancing that whole system.
Yeah, actually, chapter 11 is the chapter on that, where we talk about the negative inhibitory feedback loop and how important that cascade is, and how our systems were designed that way by the Creator, and how important it is for us to maintain that one regulatory system, because failing to do so will cause such a cascade of events to take place that they will definitely end up in something catastrophic if left unabated and continuing that one way. In other words, the physiological negative inhibitory feedback loops must be optimized and must be kept intact. Anytime you take an end hormone like testosterone or estrogen or any end hormone for that matter, you're going to inhibit that. And chapter 11, it's a heavier chapter, but it has been one of the most popular chapters in the book because once a person reads it, they understand the truth about hormonal replacement therapy and no longer want to be, you know, participating in anything to do with that.
Yeah. Well, let's take a break here. We're going to talk a little bit more cancer. There's news about cadmium in the diet, increasing breast cancer risk as well. And Dr. Bitar has talked a lot about cadmium for many things, including blood pressure issues. So we're going to add the breast cancer discussion into the mix when we come back from this break. Remember, all the links are up at robertscottbell.com. Check it out, including the links to the 9 steps to keep the doctor away. We'll be right back.
The Robert Scott Bell Show.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello, hello, hello.
Quiet, numbskulls. I'm broadcasting.
You're amazing. You are something else.
Robert Scott Bell.
She has both style and substance.
Robert Scott Bell.
How much power do talk radio hosts really have?
This is transformational, and it's awesome.
The Robert Scott Bell Show.
Talked many times with Dr. Bitar here on Advanced Medicine Monday about cadmium, heavy metal toxicity, mercury, etc. And lo and behold, another article comes out confirming what he has written about in the 9 steps to keep the doctor away, what we discuss here. This one coming from healthfinder.gov. Cadmium in diet may increase breast cancer risk. A study found women who consumed the most were 21% more likely to develop the disease, cancer. Of course, we know cadmium depletes selenium, and selenium is very protective, but there's a lot of things at play here, Dr. Bitar. It's amazing they're actually acknowledging it.
Yeah, absolutely. The oxidative stress, which is a commonality between all the, not only the heavy metals, but even the persistent organic pollutants and all the 7 toxicities we discussed about in the 9 steps, they're all, the mechanism of action is the same for all of them. As far as all chronic disease has the same mechanism of action that is the etiological factor, which is oxidative stress. And heavy metals, cadmium, mercury, lead, but specifically cadmium, mercury, and lead, those three together, they're the only three that have been studied as far as the synergistic destructive nature of metals. There's obviously many heavy metals, but the only three that I'm aware of that have been studied together to see what their levels were published in a 1970 study, and they specifically looked at lead, mercury, and cadmium, all three together. But cadmium, as we've discussed before, it's the primary reason for the hypertensive crisis in our nation. And when they talk about the cause of hypertension, the primary cause of hypertension is referred to as idiopathic hypertension, according to Cecil's textbook of internal medicine. And idiopathic essentially means in medicine that they don't know what causes it. So, and that's 85% of hypertension is supposed to be idiopathic, but we know it's cadmium. And, of course, with cancer and many of these other types of chronic diseases, that's exactly what it is.
Yeah, and they say in the article, you know, if people say, well, where am I getting cadmium from? It's like, well, if you're not eating organically grown foods, you're going to be using these farm fertilizers that contain cadmium, and so soil water sources are big. Other things. I mean, if you eat white bread, remember the old Wonder Bread of childhood, the memory bread, I used to call it that, because you can scrunch it into a little ball and it'll come right back out like it has a memory of what it looked like before. And it's crazy stuff. But yes, high cadmium levels in these refined breads as well, cereals, potatoes, root crops, vegetables. And this is the thing they're saying here, cadmium may mimic the effects of female hormone estrogen. Again, another estrogen-linked story with a heavy metal.
Yep, and that's, again, the problem with many of these substances. They have a estrogenic-type activity and causes just phenomenal levels of catastrophic changes within the system. And remember that the human body, actually the biological system, you're looking at 100,000 reactions per second per cell. So how do these substances affect our body? We just... You can just imagine the number of reactions that it's causing catastrophic changes in. I mean, it's like that domino effect that we talked about. You know, you hit one domino, and then what happens to all the dominoes downhill?
Well, I interviewed Dr. Bitar. I interviewed a guy named Bruce Ames at the Health Freedom Expo. I'm sure you've heard of him. I mean, he's a brilliant guy, and half of the interview was great. And then suddenly I started, oh, my gosh, I brought up the role of toxins and heavy metals, and he says, oh, that's nonsense. You know, that doesn't make any – you just got to do these things, right? I'm like, dude, what are you talking about? Do you understand how many things your cells are doing, what level they're doing it? Oh, yeah, but it's not that much, these pesticides. Don't worry about it. It's like – So it got contentious. I mean, here's an old 83-year-old guy, nice man, but completely off his rocker on the second phase of our interview. I had no idea we would go there. And I thought, okay, you can be right about one thing and so wrong about another. It's amazing.
What was the first part of the interview?
The interview was, you know, about the nutrient-type therapies, key nutrient specifics, counteracting certain things. I mean, there was some good information, solid science. But then suddenly I brought up the issue of the role of toxins in the diet, from food, water, air, pesticides, fungicides, all of this stuff. He's like, oh, no, we're meant to deal with that. I'm like, excuse me, these synthetic compounds were never before anywhere in the ecology, if I can call it, the environment, anywhere. And do we have the enzymes to suddenly out of nowhere be able to transform these things like you're thinking it's not a big deal? And he just brushed it off as if it didn't exist. And it was like, okay, he's got his horse blinders on.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, and he's very well looked after. I mean, I bring his name up, and people go, oh, man, he's such a smart man. And listen, I agree. I'm going to give props to my elders when they're right, but I will point out where they're wrong, and I'm going to do it respectfully. So it was just an issue where I think in an old-school scientific way, they never acknowledged that the alteration of the soils, they don't look at the law of the terrain in the same way we would, and the restoration of the terrain to watch the beauty and majesty of nature do her thing to correct everything. And so they're so immersed in the science, which I do like, but they've lost the big picture.
Yeah, it's amazing. I had no idea that he would have said something like that. That's actually pretty appalling.
I don't think anybody has questioned him on it, honestly. Maybe somebody has. I didn't know because everybody was speaking so highly of him. And like I said, he's a nice man. I wasn't mean to him or anything, but I was so surprised by it, the direction it went, that I think people respect him for the good stuff that he's done, and they don't want to bring up anything else. You know, it's like the elephant in the room. Don't point out the elephant in the room. I'm just, my nature is, if there's an elephant in the room, I'm going to say, hey, there's an elephant in the room. Sorry, but there is. And that's where he left it.
That's funny. I'm really surprised that he said that. That's pretty embarrassing that he would say something like that.
Yeah, I was embarrassed for him because, like you said, I know people have an affection for the man, and he's nice. It's the first time I met him. And as I said, he was a nice guy and intelligent. But for me, and you have that nature too, even somebody you like, you're going to point out something that might not be exactly right about it and challenge them on it and then see where it goes from there. So
I have a great deal of respect for Bruce Boyd Haley, and mm-hmm. Consider him a friend. But at least in three or four different conferences we've been at together, mm-hmm. Boyd has said something, and I've stood up and I've challenged him on it, and then he'll back down. And it's funny because he's a very smart guy, but he'll always say I don't know whether I started getting him to say this or mm-hmm. Inadvertently because I challenged him a couple of times, but he would say, well, I'm not a doctor and, I don't practice medicine, so I'm not seeing this in clinical, tell you what it does clinically, but he'll quote certain things that are seen in a Petri dish. But as you know, and
I think
as most of us in clinical medicine know, when, you take the system out of the, what happens in a Petri dish isn't what happens inside a physiological system.
I'm so glad you said that because I think that was the point, I brought it up clinically. I said, okay, I'm not going to try to match you on PhD level. I respect it, the guy. I know he knows stuff on a lot of level, but I'm saying, here are all the clinical case after clinical. These are ones right before my eyes when we remove these offending elements and detoxify them. This is the result. We weren't utilizing anything that you had talked about, and yet he couldn't conceive of it. And he didn't come to that point that Boyd Haley came to with you that same day. The guy's not a doctor. He's a researcher, and I respect him for that. But he isn't out there seeing it and helping people to get well, much less run down that road himself. So I'm glad you said that because there is a distinction there.
Yeah, and Boyd, obviously, he sent me patients. So obviously he understands that there's a difference between what he's observing and what I'm observing. And yet, we both have virtually the same understanding and the same opinion. A poison is a poison is a poison. But I think one of the points that had come up was the use of EDTA in patients without the mercury being taken out first, actually the use of EDTA potentiated the damage from the mercury. And that's what one of the rat studies had shown. And in clinical practice, that's just simply not true. I've just seen people's mentation get better mm-hmm. without using DMPS. And in the first 4 years I practiced in private practice from 1996 to 1999, I didn't use any DMPS. 1996 to 1998, the 3 years I didn't use any DMPS.
Okay.
And then I started using DMPS. And I told him, I said, look, I had treated I don't know how many patients up until that point. It must have been close to 500, 700 patients in the first couple of years. And I had never, ever seen anybody's mentation get worse with the EDTA, even though they had mercury. And, of course, we saw a much more dramatic reversal in neurological symptomology when we started using DMPS. But that's not to say that without using the DMPS that the use of EDTA potentiated and worsened the mercuric components within the system and made the people worse as far as their mentation went.
Right.
And I had to challenge Boyd on that. And to his credit, he didn't argue, and he said, "Well, I'm not a clinician, and I can't say that I've observed any of this. I'm just going by what the studies have shown in a Petri dish." And you know, again, I have a great deal of respect for Boyd, and rightly so. I should have a great deal of respect for him because he's done a lot of great work.
Yes.
And, you know, to his credit, he, you know, stepped off that box. Mm-hmm. He didn't try to challenge me or argue. You know, he backed off and he said, well, you're right. You know, you would be the person that would have seen it. I wouldn't have because I don't.
That's also why I respect that type of stuff. I'm glad you said that because I do respect Boyd as well. I've interviewed him over the years and glad to know that. And I said it's important to make a distinction. You can find certain pathways that are apparent perhaps in a rat study or even in a dish, as you say. And then you get out there clinically and start saying, dude, I've never seen that happen. So something's amiss in that. And we can't deny what we see before our very eyes, not just once or twice, but 10, 50, 100, or 1,000 times. And that's where you've got to acknowledge that there's something you may not understand or have studied in a dish as a PhD that as a clinician out there, you'll see working differently. And I'll often come into, I wouldn't say to blows with my fellow homeopaths on certain things where they'll tell me, you can't do that. This law rule, it doesn't work. And yet, I've seen it too many times. You can't tell me that it doesn't work that way. And so at that point, it becomes theoretical versus clinical again.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll give you a perfect example of this being a very popular issue right now with what's seen in a petri dish versus what's seen in actual physiological, mm-hmm. in a physiological being. Whenever I say a physiological being, the reason I don't see it in a human is because it could also be applicable to an animal. So it's sure. within the physiological environment, the biological environment. But the use of preservatives such as sodium benzoate and sodium benzoic acid. And one of the things that a lot of the health food pro people will say is that, you know, anything that has sodium benzoic acid or sodium benzoate in it is cancer causing because it produces benzene.
Mm-hmm.
Well, here's the thing that if you take benzoic acid and you put it with vitamin C in a petri dish, apparently, and again, I don't know whether this is true or not, but from what I understand from the people that have made this argument that you form benzene. Vitamin C with benzoic acid will form benzene, and benzene is a aromatic chemical. I mean, it's actually very carcinogenic.
Yes,
as you probably know, Robert.
Yes.
But here's the thing that cherries, in nature, cherries are found to have sodium benzoic acid, and cherries also happen to have vitamin C. And if you look at cherries, there is no trace of benzene whatsoever within a cherry.
Mm-hmm.
So you have these two substances that they say if you combine them in a petri dish causes benzene. Yet in the cherry, there is no sodium, there is no benzene, and yet you have vitamin C and sodium benzoic acid. Sure. So how do you explain that?
Yeah, and my view of the studies on this where there's problems were the combination of the sodium benzoate and potassium sorbate. When they were put together, there was something else going on. I don't recall as we speak here now, but that when they were utilized separately in minute doses, they weren't really problematic.
Yeah, and so it's a point that the system, the physiological system, has certain components within it. And again, it's not even, you know, we're not talking specific to the human body or even to the animal kingdom, even in the case of the cherries, we're talking about, you know, plants. So something happens within nature, within the physiological realm, that may take certain components that if you take in a petri dish and put them together could cause a problem. But inside a physiological realm, there are many other things that are taking place. And obviously, we are designed to survive. And so there's certain things that are protective. I don't know how sodium benzoic acid and vitamin C form benzene. I've never seen it, but that's what I'm told in the chemical reaction.
The
and
dish,
I
yeah.
certainly know that there's no benzene in cherries. So
right. Well, and remember the argument with some people. This is the opposite sort of argument. They'll try to defend something like aspartame because it breaks down. One of the components is methanol, you know, which
right.
is a cumulative toxic poison. But in a banana, they'll say, oh, there's methanol in there. But they forget to tell you there's also ethanol, which kind of neutralizes and counteracts it and makes it harmless. So in nature, there are always these counterbalancing things. Sometimes in a petri dish, there are not.
Yep, absolutely. You're absolutely right.
So, all right, well, let's take a break. We got a short bit to finish up today's Advanced Medicine Monday with Dr. Rasha Batar. Always a fascinating, wonderful discussion. Having a great time, as always. Check it all out, robertscottbell.com. The links are up. And if you ever have a question or comment, 866-939-BELL, 866-939-2355. Sign up for email alerts at naturalnewsradio.com. Plenty of archives. Wow, loads of awesome shows in the last year with Dr. Batar as well. You got to download them as well. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Godzilla of Health Talk Radio. Taking on bureaucrats and corporations that would stand in the way of health freedom. Here's Robert.
Boy, oh boy, when Dr. Batar and I get going, it's hard to stop, and we only have a short segment to wrap it up today, Dr. Batar, but there's a story from down under, and you just got back not long ago from Australia, and you had some great experiences there. It looks like there's a National Health and Medical Research Council. They're wanting to declare homeopathy to be unethical so that they will no longer be part of the so-called health system down there. What's your perspective on that, having been there recently?
Well, my global perspective is that whenever the medical hierarchy wants to get rid of something, if you recall, in my case with the medical board and my last skirmish with them, you remember they brought me up on ethical charges.
Yes.
So it's like when they have nothing else to go on, they just revert back to this ethical issue, you know. And what is, you know, to challenge homeopathy in Australia on an ethical basis is, you know, quite absurd. I think there's a lot of people in Australia that, at least that I came across, that are very naturally motivated, holistic, use natural substances, natural remedies, homeopathy. And I think that, like pretty much anywhere in the world, the hierarchy will have a rude awakening when they start down this avenue, down this path. And and rightly so, they should be slapped in the face for making an absurd comment like that.
Yeah, and of course there is science to support, you know, sometimes even placebo-controlled studies. But even without it, like we said, clinically, if homeopathy were completely, only, solely a placebo or less than, how would it have survived since the 1790s on planet Earth to become such a huge medical system? Just out of thin air, we keep pretending?
Yeah, you know, that's a good point. But I'll tell you, I just finished writing up an abstract for a study that we're submitting, and it was using these energy bands for a company that was started by a friend of mine, and he asked me to do a study on it. And I told him, I said, look, Brian, you've known me for a long time, and if the study comes out to be bogus, you know, I'm still going to, you know, go forward with it. And he said, no, I expect nothing less. And I had actually started already using these bands in my practice, and I have seen a tremendous benefit with patients and even in myself. And when we wrote the abstract up, interestingly enough, the placebo group did not show any worse results than the experimental group, but it was a crossover, double-blind, placebo-controlled crossover study. So the crossover basically means that at a certain point in the study, you cross the placebo group into the experimental group, into the group that's on the real stuff. And so when you looked at the first half of the study, you would expect placebo, the group to be on placebo, not to have the same effect, to have less of an effect. But actually, the placebo group had the same effect as the actual group. So you're thinking, wait a second, either the placebo group is all placebo, or the group that was really on the real stuff, you know, they just weren't getting that much effect. So it doesn't look right. But then when we crossed them over, the placebo group, into the experimental group, 18 out of the 26 that were in the placebo group saw a measurable change, and then realize, oh, wait a second, I thought I was better, but now I can really see the difference.
Wow.
And my point was in that study when I wrote that up that even, you know, obviously this clearly shows that the placebo was not as powerful as the actual thing, because when you cross the placebo group into the real group, they saw the difference. But it points out an interesting component that even in the first half of the study, the people that were in placebo felt that they were getting the real thing, and how powerful that is. And it has been shown over and over and over in science that the placebo is a significant mechanism of eliciting a response, a positive response in a patient. And my contention is very simply that as a clinician, we should use every tool at our disposal to get the desired result in the patient. And why should we not use the placebo? You know, to say that, oh, it's just placebo and just rule it off, that's ridiculous. If it's placebo and it works, then we should use it, for God's sake.
Hmm. Yes, and in the Australia case, they're making the same weak argument that, well, it's unethical because they might issue a proven allopathic pharmaceutical treatment, right?
It's competition now. Yeah. It has nothing to do with ethics.
Exactly.
It's because there are too many people using homeopathy in Australia compared to the drugs.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what needs to come back to, because medical ethics, by and large, as we see it, is an oxymoron outside of the few that we respect, and of course, including yourself, where we actually do care for the people that are coming to see us. We will not poison them, and utilizing a drug for those who have the ability to prescribe them only in the cases where it is absolutely necessary, not as a first resort, but as, you know, as you find, well, when all else is not able, then we'll come in and utilize it properly, short term, get them out, and clean them up afterwards. That is ethical.
You just saw the example of the standard ethics with mm-hmm. that woman, the oncologist, that's after the child is no longer showing any signs of cancer, wanting to give him three different drugs that have no approval in that particular type of cancer in children, and she still wants to do it, provide these drugs to the child, administer these drugs to the children, to the child, despite the parents and despite two courts saying that, no, you don't have to, and she's still pushing the agenda. So that's the ethics that we're dealing with. That's the true ethical issue.
Well, I hope next week when we're together, we'll have some better news to report on that, and maybe we'll find out who that was and put a stop to it. But in the meantime, Dr. Bitar, as always, a pleasure to have you on board here on the Robert Scott Bell Show, and, of course, the support of the 9 Steps to Keep the Doctor Away. Everybody must get that book. That's required reading here on the show. And in the meantime, till next week, remember this, that the power to heal is yours.